Good morning. Once more, we present an early morning roundup from the news capitals of the world. This morning, we are about to hear from the Far East, London, England, and our own national capital in Washington. First, a review of the news in the Netherlands East Indies. We take you now to Sidney Albright in Batavia, Java.
The Royal Army carried out an attack on a concentration of Japanese ships in the middle of the Bokassa Strait
between Guizhou and Calais. That ship, with bombs of 300 kilograms, was stored on one large warship, probably a battleship, one heavy cruiser, and one large transport ship. While furthermore, one destroyer, two large transport ships, and one smaller transport, each were hit twice with bombs of 50 kilograms during dive bombing attacks by our fighters. In total, 12 direct hits were scored on 8 ships. There were no losses on our side. Today's regular communique of the Netherlands Indies Fighting Forces contains some highly significant facts. Yesterday morning, between 9 and 10 o'clock, a new bombing attack was carried out on Balawan Deli, the seaport of Medan in North Sumatra. 16 persons were wounded, but material damage was slight. The attack was carried out by 6 enemy aircraft, which dropped 60 bombs. About 1 p.m., the port city was again bombed, this time by 3 Japanese aircraft. Damage was done to some warehouses and ships. There were no casualties. These two raids make a total of 4 in the past 3 days, and it is the general opinion of observers here that they can be taken as possible advance warning that an invasion at this point is imminent. This is based on the usual Japanese method of periodic attacks, followed up by frequent attacks just before sending landing parties. The Japanese, since their initial thrust at the Indies, have not deviated from these tactics in one single instance. Sabang in North Sumatra was the scene of another light bombardment yesterday. However, the attempt to bomb 2 ships failed. A paragraph in the communique says, apart from Balawan and Sabang, there was no enemy activity worth mentioning in the various regions of the outer provinces where the enemy has been carrying out bombardments during the last few days. Only at Gorontalo, a Japanese aircraft dropped many incendiary bombs without causing damage. Gorontalo is in the Minahasa, which was supposed to have been occupied by the Japanese several days ago, as stated in an official communique. The only conclusion to be drawn from the statement in today's communique is that the Minahasa still has not fallen entirely into enemy hands. Of course, there is the possibility that today's bombing activity may have been directed at guerrillas. The communique further states, at 11:30 this morning, 27 enemy fighting planes attacked the airdrome at Palembang in South Sumatra. 2 persons were wounded. Palembang is the largest oil center in Sumatra. In fact, in the whole of the Netherlands Indies, since the destruction yesterday of the refineries and wells at Balikpapan. Serious damage to Palembang, or the loss of this vital point, would have far-reaching effects on the Allied fuel supply. Both Tarakan and Balikpapan, having been rendered useless, leaves Palembang as the main source of supply. The strategic position of Palembang is another important factor, as it is within easy flying range of both Singapore and Batavia. There is a great deal of speculation as to the location of the base of the 27 enemy fighters. Because of the usual short flying range of such planes, it is considered likely that a carrier was used. Otherwise, the planes must have operated from a point in Johor or from Kuching. The communique concludes by saying, aircraft of the Royal Netherlands Navy on January 22nd carried out a renewed attack on Kuching and bomb storage yards at the river mouth, which were set afire. Despite constant attacks on their own cities, the Dutch forces still continued to strike at enemy bases, in line with their avowed policy of doing everything in their power to disrupt the Japanese plans.
That was Sidney Albright in Batavia. Now back to the newsroom in New York.
This is New York, and here's a dispatch from Moscow. Russian ski troops are skimming across the waist-high snowdrifts on the Moscow front in pursuit of the retreating German armies. Now, this is the picture given by the Russian government as propeller-driven sledges roar after the Nazis. Russian vanguards are said to have intercepted the Germans west of Borodino, and they claim to have spread terror and confusion in the Nazi ranks. Now, another report from overseas. This one comes from across the Atlantic, and our reporter is in London, England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Authoritative quarters in London today interpret Singapore news as meaning a general British withdrawal in Malaya at all points of resistance. The British are falling back on east, west, and the center, and the Japanese are apparently trying to snap a pincer movement to cut off the British retreating forces. Whether the British Imperial troops will be able to restore a general defensive line isn't clear from information here. The Japanese are known to have reached a point about 50 miles from Singapore. The Singapore communique today speaks of heavy fighting on the northern front. Japanese air activity against the Imperial troops is said to be heavy. The force of enemy planes that raided Singapore yesterday consisted of 54 heavy bombers with fighter escort. Six planes were shot down for certain. Civilian casualties were 58 killed and 70 injured. The Japanese made another raid on the city this morning, and one bomber was destroyed by British fighters. Authoritative quarters in London believe the Japanese have made a lot more progress in their Burma attack. Fighting is continuing, but the exact position isn't known. It's said here that the Japanese landings in the Solomon Islands are obviously aimed at the Australian north coast. Dispatches reaching London from Australia give the news that the Australian government now assumes that Japanese forces have landed at Rabaul, capital of the Bismarck Archipelago, about 850 miles from the northern tip of Australia. Mr. Ford, the acting Prime Minister of Australia, said it's clear the Japanese are going to use Rabaul as a base from which to strike further south, and he declared Australians must face further hazards with firm resolve, courage, and cool heads. They're telling a little story in London about a British pilot. When the Japanese made their first landing in Malaya, his plane was so badly damaged by anti-aircraft fire that he had no chance of getting back to his base. He swerved his machine around while he still had the height and dived it into the middle of one of the enemy landing craft. All the 60 Japanese aboard were killed. British bombers last night made a heavy attack on Münster in Germany. Big fires were left burning, and the British attacked the Dunkirk docks and enemy aerodromes in Holland and northern France. Weather news is important war information for the enemy, so British papers haven't printed the usual stories about weather since the war began. The only spot in the British Isles where weather news isn't banned is the Straits of Dover. The idea is that the Germans know the weather in the Straits anyway, so there can be no secret about it. Yesterday, the temperature fell to about 18 above zero there. Pretty cold weather for England. Seawater froze in pools on the sand, and the day is said to have been the coldest of the winter in the Dover Straits. The frigid weather wasn't the only thing the people of Dover had to deal with. The Germans fired 21 shells at the Dover area from the big guns on the French coast. We're allowed to say that winter conditions were general throughout Britain during the first 13 days of this month. Snow fell in most districts and frost was severe. Road service was dislocated, but the railroads are said to have been not badly affected. A member of Parliament yesterday told the House of Commons that a group of members set out from Glasgow expecting to arrive in London for Tuesday's sitting of the House. They didn't get here until the Wednesday sitting, and the whole journey took them nearly 27 hours. Stronger pressure is apparently being brought to bear on Mr. Churchill to make some government changes. The continued failure in Malaya is stiffening criticism, and now a committee of backbench Conservative members is reported to be trying to get him to change the government. What the Prime Minister will do is undoubtedly up to him alone. If he persists in asking the House to give him a vote of confidence, and if he defends his government as a body, he'll get the support of the Commons. When he gets up to speak, his personal magnetism and the fact that he can usually give the House good news to offset the bad put him in a position to override criticism. But his critics wish that he wouldn't guard inofficial inefficient ministers and officials with his own personal popularity. They feel that he should replace some of the members of his government and still so strengthen the country's war effort. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
For news at home, we turn now to Earl Godwin, speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. President Roosevelt's Office of Facts and Figures, which is headed by Archibald MacLeish, today cleared away a lot of the gloom and the pessimism which the Truman Report had emitted last week. That report, which several unemotional observers of high station here said had been overwritten and sounded as if somebody was running for office, cast suspicion on many things. That was a report from that special investigating committee in the Senate, which is investigating the program of defense. And it reported particularly on the efficacy or the lack thereof of the present output of American fighting planes. It said a great many tough things about American planes, put them in the rear seat, said only one type of plane was any good or worse to that effect. From the Office of Facts and Figures today comes the statement that the Army is putting out four types of fighting planes which are superior to anything produced abroad. This report, however, says that 1,000 American planes have been ferried by air abroad. It does not so state, but it is quite likely that most of these planes went to Britain. Incidentally, and not a part of any report, but military communiques and military dispatches from the field and from war correspondents certainly do take issue, have taken issue in advance with the Truman Report in many an instance. Air superiority has been gained suddenly because of the advent of American planes. This Facts and Figures volume, which is simply one of many which will come out in the duration of the war, now contains a rather tremendous array of all sorts of facts and figures. And to a person searching for light in this rather acidulous gloom, it's a great lifesaver. Washington is still filled with acidy backbitings and jealousies, plus the necessary lack of accurate military information, which cannot be given to the public. And from me to you, I'll say there seems to be indicated the great necessity for something helpful and constructive. And I believe the Arch MacLeish volume of Facts and Figures is just what the doctor ordered this morning. The Senate and House now have another compromise version of the price control bill before them. Each House will have a chance to accept or reject this one, which has in it a single-headed price control, Henderson, of course, no restrictions on labor and wages, and a moderate ceiling up to which farm prices can rise before Mr. Henderson can crack down. It is the ceiling denoted by what is known as 110% of parity. It is not the higher ceiling, 120% of parity, demanded by the farm bloc and moved into the Senate bill by Senator O'Mahony. However, other senators say this bill, if enacted, will permit living costs to rise 30% before they can be curbed. The veto power over price control for the farmers is retained by Secretary of Agriculture Wickard, although the President has said that this is bad administration. We don't know whether the House and Senate will pass it or whether the President will sign it or not. But anyhow, the House today has before it a $12 billion war fund appropriation bill, largest in history, providing for the spending for war from July 1st of this year to June 30th of next year. Typical was the action yesterday in okaying without a record vote another $1 billion for cargo vessels to be built by the U.S. Maritime Commission. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And with that report, ladies and gentlemen, we conclude this morning's roundup of the world capitals. Reporting their news direct to you in the United States. Our reporters on this program were Sidney Albright from Batavia, and you recall he headlined his report with the good news that the Air Forces in the East had made 12 direct hits on 8 Japanese warships. John McVane from London and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.